All right, well, let's take another look or a different look at another part of the president's State of the Union address last night, because towards the end, the president called for unity.
This, in fact, is our new American moment. There has never been a better time to start living the American dream.
But if indeed this is a new American moment, it feels like an awfully divided one, because Americans, 2-1, believe that President Trump has divided the country since his election. That's 61% to 32% believe that, according to an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll from earlier this month. So let's talk about the impact the president's first year has had on the cultural fabric of the country. And joining me now to do so is Tricia Rose. She's a professor and director of Brown University's Center of, for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Professor Rose, it's great to have you back.
Hey, great to be here.
So if indeed this is a new American moment, in the president's words, how would you describe what this moment is?
Well, it's a tragic return to a much more explicit and long history in American society of fear and race baiting and racial hierarchy. I mean, you know, you can't the racialization of the southern border of the United States is critical to this whole immigration conversation and the culture it's fomenting. I mean, remember, when he talks about people pouring over the borders, we're not talking about Canada, and we're talking about a kind of racialization of Mexican immigrants that is part of a long history of criminalizing non-whites, right, which really begins with emancipation and the end of slavery, when black people who are not enslaved become dangerous because they're free. And so there's a whole history that's being invoked here. I mean, the worry about drugs, I would have loved a little bit of discussion about oxycodone. I mean, Big Pharma is not a discussion, right? I mean, so in other words, it's both what he's saying and what he's not saying that work together to reinforce some very insidious racial and other hierarchies.
You know, to be perfectly honest, in listening to the president's speech, there were points of it which I found pretty compelling and interesting. You know, his call for infrastructure, his call to reduce the cost of prescription drugs, et cetera. But ultimately, after the hour and a half, I came away feeling that these were all sort of it was basically sugarcoating. What, you know, he probably believes that he genuinely wants these initiatives, so I'm going to grant him that, but sugarcoating around what was fundamentally a hard-hearted nativist vision for America. Because the heart of it was his anti-immigration stance.
Right. And the other heart of it, too, was that, you know, we're going to be tough. We're going to be rigid. We're going to cut ourselves off. There was no sense of our relationship to the world. And so it was a kind of isolation that is often been about being afraid of other groups of people being a part of the United States, non-whites in particular. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think your reading there is right on.
Yeah. But on the other hand, also, I'm going to acknowledge that I feel like this is exactly what many Americans want. I mean, Steve Kornacki at NBC News wrote that President Trump, quote, was a culture warrior as a candidate, and he's a culture warrior as a president. Maybe deep down, that's exactly what 46.4% of Americans want. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, you know, there's no question that one of the things that he's been very successful at achieving is the kind of taking the lid off of the deep cultural changes around sexism and about racism and homophobia that the civil rights movement, the queer rights movement, and the women's rights movement were so important in facilitating. So the goal here was to make some long-term changes for diversity, for inclusion, for egalitarianism for everybody. And that produced resentment for whites, particularly white straight men, but not only them, and working class ones, that there's resentment that those others were being allowed to impinge on their space. So he has been able to take that kind of sentiment and just made it completely emotionally and socially acceptable to say things in public that we were working to end as part of the public culture. Mm-hmm. So there is a sense that he's doing this profound work of emotional confirmation of some well-established, sometimes unconscious, forms of bias that are critical to the formation of the U.S. nation state. So it's very disturbing to see that these things are being influentially top-down expressed in irresponsible ways. So, I think this question of, like, what do people want? Like, are people just expressing what they already believe? This presumes that we're not in the business of being shaped and that our ideas are not being reinforced or solidified by media, by education and the like. So I see human beings as, and Americans obviously specifically, as being much more changeable, right? So this is hardening something that has been going on for a long time rather than encouraging a kind of egalitarian democracy mm-hmm. with an attentive sort of process.
Yeah. So that emotional confirmation that you're talking about, I mean, is he emotionally confirming or affirming this desire for, I guess, people are going to get mad at me, but I'm going to just say it, a form of white authoritarianism, right? I mean, his posture is all about it's male, it's militaristic, it's macho. I mean, that's actually
right.
I got to give a hat tip to the New York Times. I borrowed that language from them. But I mean, is that what he's affirming?
Yeah, that's a very significant part of it. Look, you know, one of the things that big corporations in collusion with government has done for the past 40 or 50 years or more is just gut the working class, gut the middle class, and all of the policies that Republicans and Democratic administrations put in place to nurture as much opportunity as possible. So as that's been receding, you know, white working class members who themselves don't understand themselves as racially being targeted, they only see themselves as class being targeted, they're very vulnerable to participating and sort of identifying with this, even though all the policies are working against them. But it gives them emotional, or what Du Bois, the great black sociologist, called the wages of whiteness, so that there's a kind of whiteness as a value in and of itself. And the masculinity of it, the toxic heteronormative masculinity, is staggering. Mm. I mean, it's a lot of what I think has, you know, turned the tide for women, some of whom see themselves as feminists, for really standing up for women in a broader way for the first time in a very long time.
But I wonder what you make of this. I mean, we're talking about President Trump as a deeply divisive figure in American politics. But, you know, that word divisive, for the entire duration of the two Obama administrations, people on the right frequently said Barack Obama is the most divisive president of in American history. I mean, just reflect with me on that maybe it's just a different side of the political spectrum right now that's feeling the edge of the division.
Well, you know, I actually, what I see as divisive is not only the policy initiatives, but the kinds of language and approach and the incapacity to emphasize the value of facts, right? So what – it's sort of a cauldron of forces that are coming together. We've always been divided politically in a lot of ways, but the notion that you could catch someone in a lie or have some fundamental – you know, values, moral values, ethical values, truth-telling values that were supposedly shared across the political spectrum was a uniting force. We literally have no consequences for the buckets full of extraordinary lies and just inventions that come up every day. No one can keep up. So it's not only emotional confirmation, it's also that factual content is literally no longer a gotcha. So you can say, here are the 10 lies that were told, and we move on.
Yeah.
It's literally. I mean, have you seen any consequences? I mean, it's not even – you don't even have to say, oh, I got it wrong. There's no, like, right, wrong, whatever, right?
Right.
So this makes for total polarization because it means all that's left is emotional confirmation. Mm-hmm. So you're either telling me what I want to hear or you're telling me what I don't want to hear. Facts don't matter.
Professor Rose, one last question for you. I mean, this has been a really interesting conversation, but I also admit I brought a little bit of pessimism to it in terms of my feeling about sort of the culture writ large over the past year. But I remind myself, America is a massive country. It's diverse, right? I mean, maybe we're underestimating the resilience of this cultural fabric that we're talking about. And so with that in mind, like, as you look forward to this coming year, this 2018 that we're in, what do you look forward to?
Well, you know, I do think that one of the things that he's been able to do is not so much divide people as much as inspire a whole generation of young people and of a variety of racial and ethnic and sexual and, you know, immigrant, non-immigrant backgrounds to really get active at every level. So the few things that super inspire me are, one, the numbers of, you know, extremely diverse first-time political office candidates who are literally challenging the extraordinary white male stronghold on governance, with gender, with sexuality, with transgender candidates and others. It's just a groundswell. That's one. The second one is this second year of the Women's March, which was bigger than the first. You know, that is super inspiring. And the third is, you know, Black Lives Matter, and the not only as a grassroots movement, which is brilliant and growing, but its diversification and net neutrality and Color of Change and other organizations that are beginning to work together to really create, you know, formidable challenges. The Me Too movement is obviously critical for women. I would consider that part of the Women's March. But these kinds of activities and actions are massive, and mm-hmm. I'm extremely hopeful that they'll expand and create more, not just opportunity, but fairness, and restore some opportunities and fairness for everybody.
Well, Tricia Rose is director of Brown University's Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Professor Rose, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Magna. Take care.